So I was sitting in my friend's garden in Ferndale one morning, and it hit me. If this could heal me, could it heal Detroit? Because Detroit and me were the same. We were both
you
coming back.
You are a Detroiter, is that right?
Oh, I was born and raised in Detroit. Of course, yeah. I've lived other places. But at that time, with the loss of, you know, the loss of my mother and son, the loss of my loft, my home, and the loss of money. And there was nothing out there called a job that I could do. And I was heading on that course in a little boat called, I'm gonna do what I love to do no matter what, no matter what, no matter what, no matter what. In 2011, 2012, Detroit was just crawling up and peeking its head. You could buy a house for a dollar, you know? And I was in the same moment.
As Detroit.
Emotionally, financially, everything. So that's why I started to think about in the garden, the secret side of Twisted Story. If it could heal me, could it heal Detroit?
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Powering Up, a cross-generational, cross-cultural conversation about female power, what it looks like, why it's important, and what we can all do to claim our power and put it to work individually and collectively. I'm Ann Doyle, your host and author of Powering Up, How America's Women Achievers Become Leaders, and I would say a veteran cultural boat rocker. Today's topic is a fascinating topic about the art, craft, and the healing power of storytelling. And I am thrilled to have as my guest the wild and wonderful Satori Shakur. She's an artist, a singer, a nationally acclaimed storyteller, a joy-filled, sexy veteran of live performance, and she also calls herself a social entrepreneur. But she's using her many, many skills today to help the incredible healing and transformation of our beloved Detroit. Welcome, Satori.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me and having me. I'm going to enjoy the conversation.
Oh, yeah. And because this is a cross-generational conversation, I have my frequent co-host and 29-year-old millennial niece, Monica Doyle, here today. Hey, Monica.
Hi. How's it going?
Okay, are you ready for this ride, wild ride, that Satori's about to take us on?
Yeah, especially after watching some of the videos. It was fantastic.
Oh, yeah, you can find all kinds of video on YouTube about Satori. So we're going to get to know her a little bit. I want to give you just a little bit more background about Satori because she's really had this amazing, fascinating career on her life journey. Most recently, she's the founder, the producer, and the host of a very, very special icon in Detroit in some ways. It's called the Secret Society of Twisted Storytellers, and it's the third Friday of every month, and it's streamed live from Detroit. She's also the host of the Moth Story Hour in SLAM in Ann Arbor. She's recently been chosen as a Kresge Literary Arts Fellow. Early recognition in her career, her background as a singer, recording artist, touring the world with George Clinton and P-Funkadelic as one of the Brides of Frankenstein. You can see that video too. She's a stand-up comedian, a writer, a founding member of a very prestigious theater company in Canada. And she began her professional storytelling career in 2011. When you started touring the country as with the Moth Story Hour as one of the main stage storytellers, and then you moved, of course, to creating this amazing piece here in Detroit that's gone national also. But you know, it's fascinating thinking about your career, Satori, because you know, you have moved from one thing to the next, and I could really relate in some ways because I also have sort of, some people might look at us and think you can't keep a job or you've got kind of a zigzag career, but it's all evolving. It's a constant evolution, and I think it's coming from a very personal place. Is that right? Yeah, so let's start by talking about this, the whole Secret Society of Twisted Storytellers and your vision about healing a community through storytelling. How did you come up with that idea? What was the thinking?
Well, I was, it's 2011, and all of my money and opportunities, they were drying up. The money was, I was figuring out how to pay for the U-Haul truck and the storage space because I was moving out of my loft of 8 years into a bedroom in my sister's house because Wall Street had crashed. I was on unemployment.
And you've made some money in your life.
No, I didn't make that much money. I'm a theater artist.
Oh, okay.
And I was a theater artist then, but I had been supporting myself as a theater artist for 12 years. So I enjoyed my life. So the wealth part, it was, you know, the money was great, but the wealth of doing what I love to do. And it turned to be a job. You know, acting became a job. Because I was looking for a job. Mm-hmm. So I would take parts and do parts to make money. Mm-hmm. And some of the parts were wonderful, you know, and other parts, you know, but I had to survive. So I moved into a bedroom in my sister's house, and at the same time, a friend of mine, Maggie, who lives in Ferndale, told me about the Moth Story Slam at Cliff Bell's, and you should come. And so when I walked in, I was like, oh my God, they're telling stories. Well, that's what I do. I tell stories. That's how I communicate. You know, I'm a stand-up comedian, and as a stand-up comedian, that's what I did. I told stories. Now, I earned my way to tell the story. I had to perfect a bit. I had to let them know, yes, I'll make you laugh. And then I would say, now I'm going to tell you a story. I said, I promise you're going to laugh. I just don't know when. And then they would sit back in their seats like little kids, and I would start, you know.
Yeah, so this was part of you. I mean, I heard one time where you said, you know, I come from a long, long line of storytellers.
Yes.
You reached back and found that when you went to that Moth Story Hour?
Well, I never left it. It's like if you speak French, if you grow up in a French-speaking household, then you speak French. If you grow up in a storytelling household, you speak storytelling. And that's how the older women, my mother was the youngest of all these older women, you know, and they all came from the South, Jim Crow. Some of them, Mama Smith, she died. She came from before the 1900s. She was old at that point. But they all came from the South, very church-going, some of them were educated school teachers, but my mother didn't make it past the ninth grade because she had to pick cotton. It was the racist South, Mississippi.
Your mother?
Yeah, my mother. My mother, yeah, wow. She was from Holly Bluff, Mississippi, Yazoo County, the most racist county in the South. Mm-hmm. She came up to Detroit because my uncle was here. He had a church, but she and her pregnant cousin were being pursued by white farmers. And back then in 1930-something, if a white man wanted a black woman, it didn't matter whether she was married, whether she was pregnant. She didn't have a say about her body. And so they shipped them both north to escape those unwanted attentions. So she, when she got here, she was 17, and she was going to go to Barber Junior High. And she was the oldest kid, and she felt, you know, intimidated, embarrassed, so she started housekeeping and, you know, mm-hmm. started being a maid in Grosse Pointe. And she was a maid in very affluent households in the Detroit area.
So take me back to that moment that you had this whole experience of realizing, wow, what is in my blood and my history, this storytelling?
Well, when I heard them telling stories, I felt like, wow. I could do that.
I speak that language.
Oh, my God. I had so many stories. I had stories in my file cabinet. I had stories in my head. I didn't even want... I had to conform to the steps of stand-up comedy, but once I found out who I was and I didn't give a shit about being funny, I already am, then I could just, you know, tell the stories, you know.
What point did you start looking for those stories in other people, too? Because just out in the hall, I saw you pointing to that picture and saying, that person has a story, that person has a story.
That's how I love people. I look at them and I go, I wonder who they are. So I start asking them questions, and I always have been surprised by some of the questions that I ask people, how willing they are to tell me. Mm-hmm. I used to walk out on stage and say, how many women in the room masturbate? And I mean, I'm like, really? Y'all got your hands out?
Like, no hands up,
huh? Then we have a conversation about it.
Uh-huh.
It's a good icebreaker.
Right, yeah.
I remember doing, when I lived in L.A., I was part of this performance artist troupe of women called Women on a Mission. And everybody had something different that they do. My thing was I just wanted to walk out on stage and talk about whatever was current. So this place was all lesbian women, all queer women.
Uh-huh.
And so the top cover of Time, it was said Lipstick Femme. So I'm like, whoa. So I said, well, and my boyfriend was videoed. He offered to videotape. So I asked the audience, I said, well, what is a lipstick femme, you know? And so this big woman, big, you know, man, lean woman, I'll show you. And I said, well, come on up. So she came up, just before she was about to kiss me, my boyfriend said, I don't play that shit.
No.
She ran off the stage. It was a ripple that went over the women in the audience.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was so angry. I shouted at him. I said, don't you fuck with me when I'm on stage. This is my land. Don't you...
And ooh, the women... You don't own me.
And then the lady in the audience, I said, what kind of fucking lesbian are you to leave me up here by myself when a man is getting ready to attack me? You ain't real.
Oh, my God. Did she come back up?
No. It started a whole discussion.
Oh, yes. Ooh.
The women started to talk about voices, harsh voices, and rape, and all kind of thing. I felt like I was, like, Oprah Winfrey or something. I was just...
Wow.
They were telling their story. And my boyfriend was so upset with me. And I was...
And you were upset with him, right?
I'm like...
Right.
Yeah, this is the line, man.
Yeah. But bring me back to Detroit. I mean, as I said, you know, Monica, I said, hey, we can go all over the place with this.
Oh, yeah.
Right, right. But bring me back to Detroit and the idea that you had about using this to heal.
Yes. So I told my story at the Moth, and I won the Story Slam. So that means when you win the Story Slam, you go to the next level of competition, which is the Grand Slam. And that was at the Gym Theater. I knew the Gym Theater well because I'd done Menopause the Musical. And I had the intention of using a story because I was exploring storytelling, you know, and I'd read an article about this Jewish man who had went to, Zambia. He went to a remote place in the continent of Africa, and he was teaching them to tell stories so that they could go to the UN and receive money, and support.
Right.
So I was like, because I realized, you know, storytelling
Not is, just for yourself, but for others.
Yes. So I was in survival now. I didn't have a job. I was living in a bedroom in my sister's house. So this, I had a lot at stake. So I told my girlfriend my story of applying for a job at Macy's, which people can find online, Point of No Return.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah. Okay. And it's just my story of wanting to do what I'd love to do for the rest of my life and being afraid. And finally, I was pushed to the point where, okay, I'm willing to work. And I went on a job interview at Macy's and they rejected me.
You can't tell that story right now. We want to
hear
about
it. I'm just saying it was a lot at stake. So
yeah.
I made the story. I told that story at the Moth, the gym, at the gym theater.
At the next level.
And I didn't win. I came in second, but the Moth came to me and said, would you like to host the new slam that we're starting in Ann Arbor? And that was, I thought I would get a job at a health food store. I like people. I like health. And that's what I thought. But the Moth actually came and said, would you like a job? And I'm like, this is doing what I love. They offered me $50. I asked them, could I have an extra 10 for gas? Because I was living now in a bed in the basement of my friend Maggie's house in Ferndale.
Right.
So I did that. And I said, yes, I do it. Then the next day they called and said, can you do the main stage? We're going to be at the Fillmore Theater. And I said, yeah. So they said, do you have a story? And I said, yes. And I told the story of losing my mother and my son 9 months later. I'd never told that story. I walked out on the Fillmore stage shaking because I didn't know whether I could get through it. And I got through it, and then the story turned, and the audience was like in stitches. They were like on the floor. And so then the Moth said that I was a rock star, and would I come and do fly someplace else and do something else? And I said, yes. And then they asked me, would I do the Moth Radio Hour? And they flew me out to New York. I did the Moth Radio Hour, which they put on PRX and NPR, and it all over, and podcasts. And so I started getting letters from all over the world. And then I told the story a second time by their request, and then finally the third time in Boston. When I was telling it, it was my story, and I didn't have the same pain. There was some distance. Mm-hmm. And so there was awareness that, wow, I can say this. Mm. And there's, but then what I was most aware of was the way they were listening to me, like so profound. I'd never been heard like that, you know? And it hit me right then, wow, everybody should be heard like this, no matter who they are, what they've done, because this is a gift. This is transformative. I felt love. I probably integrated that 900 person audience.
Wow.
I was,
yeah.
But it was the
connected them. There was some kind of a human
spirit
connected.
And I'm like, how did 900 people sit together and you don't even hear a paper wrapper, nothing? And so it was like I was speaking into this pool of possibility. Like anything I put in there would be whatever it was lifting. And so when I got back to Detroit, I knew that this was, I didn't know what. So I was sitting in my friend's garden in Ferndale one morning, and it hit me. If this could heal me, could it heal Detroit? Because Detroit and me were the same. We were both
coming
back.
You are a Detroiter, is that right?
Oh, I was born and raised in Detroit. Of course, yeah. I've lived other places. But at that time, with the loss of, you know, the loss of my mother and son, the loss of my loft, my home, and the loss of money. And there was nothing out there called a job that I could do. And I was heading on that course in a little boat called, I'm going to do what I love to do no matter what, no matter what, no matter what, no matter what.
What year was that?
This was 2012, July 19th, 2012.
2012. So here we are, you know, 6 years later.
Yes.
And it's sold out, and it's, you know, you can see it everywhere. It's live streamed. It's filled. I mean, Monica, I know you've gone to these things.
Yep.
What's your remembrance of the first time you went?
Well, I didn't entirely understand what it was. You know, it takes a little while to realize what it is. It almost is like a stand-up comedy routine, but it's a little bit more personal than that because, you know, they're not just pushing buttons to try and get you to laugh. You know, it's also sharing a little bit more of yourself than just a comedy show would. But in turn, it is funny, you know, through relatable content. But honestly, one of the biggest things that I've liked from watching some of your videos and from being at that show was that, you know, you kind of bring up this subject of women, you know, embracing their sexuality and stuff like that. It's fascinating to me because, you know, having experienced growing up from a little girl, this kind of shame-based society that we live in, it's really refreshing to see people come up on stage, like not only you, but other people come up on stage and share really personal parts of themselves that everybody experiences. You know, we keep this stuff down and we don't talk about it because we're ashamed of it. And that, I think that was the thing I appreciated most about a lot of these stories, is just kind of opening up about parts of life that people ignore.
So you have a long list of questions.
I do.
We can go all over the place. Where do you want to go with this conversation?
Well, I am kind of curious how you started finding other people to tell stories. Like, did you have friends? Did people come to you and say, I have a story to tell?
Well, I started with the people that I knew that told stories at the Moth. And at the time, I was still doing stand-up. I started back doing stand-up, going to Joey. So I had comedians to choose from, and then just people that I would target.
But this is called, I mean, for anyone who's listening, it's called the Secret Society of Twisted Storytellers.
Yes, yes.
And where can they find it?
Where can they find our website?
Yeah, to listen, because you have your own. It's a podcast. It's
yes.
It's on YouTube.
Well, please first visit our website, and you'll find everything mm-hmm. that we do there. And you can go to twistedstorytellers.org. And you can find out the things that we do. We offer workshops in the community. We program other public spaces. I do a lot of speaking. I go to churches. I go where anybody wants me to go, or I will send a storyteller when they want something specific. We're doing a lot, so I encourage people to come and tell their stories, because everybody is a human library of wisdom and experience. And when we go and we haven't told our story. We haven't, because that's really our legacy, isn't it? If no one knows what your story is and you haven't, and no one tells it after you're gone, you disappear. But we have the benefit of technology now. So your story, Anne Doyle, and please come tell yours. It will live forever. It's like a library of the first sports writer.
Yeah, I told the story. She got me up there. I told the story.
It's a movie.
How much practice and rehearsal and coaching goes into each person's story?
I like to do 1 hour per week.
With each person?
Yes, a draft per week. Then we have a rehearsal and then the show on Friday. But we are not trying to memorize word mm-hmm. for word what we're doing.
Well, and it doesn't come off like that at all. No. It comes off really conversational and stream of consciousness mm-hmm. when you're watching these mm-hmm. things. It's like you're talking to the person, except you don't have the other half of the conversation. You just get to listen.
Yeah. But your listening is the other part of the conversation.
Yeah.
When you hear the tears, you hear the silence, you hear the laughter, you hear the... No, you hear human beings being empathetic listeners,
yep. mm-hmm.
being with you, having that ride with you. I love people. I love unzipping them and hearing their stories. I love asking the questions.
And you do, but you had this vision about those unzipping, those individual stories, but in this bigger concept mm-hmm. about helping Detroit, a community
yes.
that sort of to the world is a city, a great, great city that has gone through very, very bad times and has been in a moment of healing for a long time. And really, there's incredible acceleration of that healing going on right now.
Well, that's exactly what I was at. In 2011, 2012, Detroit was just crawling mm-hmm. up and peeking its head. You could buy a house for $1, mm-hmm. you know, and I was in the same moment
as Detroit.
Emotionally, financially, everything. So that's why I started to think about in the garden, the secret side of Twisted Story. If it could heal me, could it heal Detroit? Because Detroit have lost mothers and sons and fathers and people and schools, and it was under emergency management, democracy. People were wounded. I was, and then statistics would criticize the number of people that turned out at the polls, and I was. Really, I remember myself when I was crawling through the hell of grief. Did I vote? I don't even remember who was running. What?
Yeah.
You have no energy except to grieve. Grief is its own. It's a hospital. You're talking about healing. Grief should be, I don't want to say should, but my experience is that when I embrace grief, because I am an actor, but more than that, I'm a scientist. I'm an ontologist, so I'm interested in the being of human beings. So there's always a part of me that's observing, and maybe that's the big, omniscient part, but there's a part of me observing all the time. So grief became a whole new world to explore. There was a freedom in it, a freedom to say whatever the hell I wanted to say, but I was at a stage where I could be responsible. I had to learn how to be responsible for the pain that came through maybe a thing that I was saying that was true, but I didn't need to be angry because my son and my mother were gone. That didn't have to be part of the recipe of, so I had to put myself back together in a way that I wasn't angry at God.
But life gets everybody, and how you deal with that,
Grief is a baptism. It's a baptism. It cleanses you if you allow it. People want to put it off, but there are stages, and I respect the stages, and I encourage everybody to go to the grief support group because you need that. You got to go through it, and you need support going through it because you don't want to go through it,
And how can telling stories help with that?
When you get to a place where you can tell the story, you tell it, it becomes a cleansing. You tell it because you need to tell it. And sometimes you mitigate whether you should tell it.
Talked about going on that stage the first time that you told that publicly,
yes,
not sure if you could get through
it. You're not sure. You don't know where you are in 6 years later. It's bottled up. It's like I haven't even truly these are intimate places. I don't know whether I trust to say. I've never told anybody about Claxton Macy's, you know, by seeing the mannequin with him dressed, you know, I don't know. But the way the people were listening, I could hear tears, and then I knew I was doing a service. I knew there was something that I had to do. I'm an actor, so I'm used to being on stage. I'm used to being on stage, even as my mother was dead, going on menopause musical, change, and go off stage and say, can you hold the curtain just for a couple of seconds before we do the Sonny and Cher piece? And going back out there, so you're trained to
perform, but that's not that's covering up.
Yes, but I'm used to being present even though this other thing is going on. So to recognize and be in touch with the audience who's also, because if I touch someplace, you release. We don't fully grieve. We don't get it all out in one cry. 3-10 years later, you might find yourself in a, so it's like, how, you know, what if all of us could serve each other, you know, by telling the story? What if storytelling is a gift? It's this person's willingness to be a human being and accept themselves in public in front of everybody and demonstrate how beautiful that is, how rich that is, and how generous it is, you know, to give that to somebody else and find out that even, because most of the storytellers, they tell me, even their big public speakers and things, they are terrified. Mm-hmm. They pace the hall.
Even
they
the ones
sweat.
Who are great at this stuff?
It's different. It's not a speech. It's
right.
You're not presenting.
Right.
You're,
and the best of it is opening up to something real, right? Sharing something very, very real about being a human.
Well, and I haven't done a great deal of performing in my life, but I can honestly say, looking back, I've never done a single performance and regretted it later. You know, before you go up to do these types of things, speaking, poetry slams, acting, you know, you're afraid, you're hesitant to go up. But once you're done, it's the opposite of that. It's relief. It's being proud of yourself for doing it. I've never regretted any performance I've ever done, whether I messed up or not.
Mm-hmm. You know, we don't have, we could talk for a long time, but I want to make sure we cover a few more things. But what else do you want to make sure you get a chance to ask about here?
I am curious to know how you decide which stories to tell, because some of them are more profound and some of them are more simple, like going to get your feet done. That was a great one. You know, and it's a story. I think it was like a 20-minute video that I was heavily engaged in about going to get a pedicure. And
that people can find that, right?
Yeah, they can find it. It's hysterical and very relatable. But I'm curious to know, like, with all the profound things that have happened to you, what makes you decide now's the time to tell a profound story about, like, grief in my life, or now's the time to tell that story about the time I went to get a sexy pedicure?
It just happened. I mean, I just had that pedicure. I mean, it was present to me. You know, it was a story that I hadn't told. Most of the stories I hadn't told. So it was an opportunity to tell a story. And because to me, it was more about, this is nurturing. Mm-hmm. You know,
but the thing that was really interesting about that is because something almost mundane like getting a pedicure, you do end up discussing more profound things. You know, you have like an emotional response. The guy giving you the pedicure was also having an emotional response, recalling, you know, Vietnam, things like that. And it takes something mundane and you kind of put some of the profound subjects into that as well. Mm-hmm. But it all revolves around a pedicure, you know, enjoying getting your feet massaged.
Yeah. I want to get your thoughts about where we are as a country right now, because mm-hmm. this whole topic that we're into about healing and grief and mm-hmm. human connection and everything mm-hmm. makes me think about where we are in the United States of America right now. And the world is watching us. Mm-hmm. And it seems like it's the worst in my lifetime. I guess I'm old enough to remember some of the stuff, the tail end of the civil rights things and the anti, you know, the Vietnam War, those pieces when our country was very, very divided. Mm-hmm. But this is one of the worst times that I can remember in terms of the anger in this country, the division in this country. What are your thoughts about all that, Corey, and I mean, Satori, and how we can start to heal?
I think that that what is happening in the country and in the world is exactly what's supposed to be happening in the country and the world.
Do you?
Yes. I see this as one of the most... This we are living in the shifting of the shift. We have that privilege. We are living in the in where we're going to go. Mm-hmm. As a world, mm-hmm. What kind of human beings?
It's like a paradigm shift, a cultural
paradigm shift. Yes, yes, and so there is a struggle. Are we gonna be in the past, or are we gonna move forward and evolve? Because we have technology. We're still in survival psychologically and emotionally as human beings. We still think we have to kill and dominate each other to live and have a fabulous life.
That's me against you. You know, there's only so much, and we're fighting for our piece of it.
That's the old model of living together. And so I think that Trump, I've been doing a lot of things, I think Trump is the perfect president for the country, because this is, to me, how the country has always been. It's just had a little sheen, a little polish. People were comfortable because their roles were very committed to their roles.
Mm-hmm. That was that politically correct piece that was a sheen around it?
Yeah, I mean, since 60s. We're not really, really don't want you in our schools. We really don't want you, but we're going to tolerate it.
Well,
and so it's not.
Sorry.
Very uncomfortable.
No.
Right. I mean, it's not uncomfortable for me, but I'm saying, you ask me, and I'm saying.
No,
I think,
want to talk about it. I mean, Trump says, people need to talk about it. Isn't that what storytelling is about?
Trump says some things that, like they said, a broken clock is right twice a day. Trump says some things that no matter what the messenger looks like, whether you like his policies, he can say something that has honesty in it, that has a measurable truth. And he says, question the press, fake news. Question the FBI. You know, they're not integritous. Question the press. Question this and that. Now, we want the FBI. We want the journalists and the news to be integrous. We want that because we want to win this struggle that's happening now between what we perceive as a bad thing and a good thing. But as an African American, the FBI wasn't good. They weren't fair to black people. The press was definitely not fair. They created stories and printed some lies and everything. So that is something I can't deny that he said that I can measure in history that is so. But I don't agree with his ideologies. I don't feel included in his policies. I think he's there to, like he said, drain the swamp. And once the swamp is drained, there we all are. Because we've all carried some little piece of why the world was like it is. Now, we're this influx of millennials, whom I love. I'm a born-again millennial because millennials are saying, I'd rather take 3 cents and do what I love.
You're right.
I'm going to create a hotel, an Airbnb, and I'm not going to own a damn room. I'm going to have a limousine service.
And that's who's listening to podcasts right now, which is why I want... Monica here and my millennial nieces and nephews, and I'm a big fan too. I love that you're a born again millennial.
Yeah, but one more thing to finish, because I don't want to leave your listeners with where I stop with that idea. What I'm saying is, as a big fan of The Walking Dead, this is like a moment between Rick and Negan. It's like, what is the future going to look like? Because we are in the shifting of the shift. The zombies, we didn't handle the zombies. Mm-hmm. Okay, now it's really, here we are. We're confronting how we're going to be as human beings. Are we going to be kind, gentle, a community of people? Or are we going to be having control over other people, force and fear? And so each of us in the shifting has an opportunity to say how it's going to go. I am standing with and for a world that works for everyone. You know, I'm standing for love and possibility because I know that's all there is. At the end of the day, all there is love. But there is that struggle. You know, you just mull it around, and then you want to approach people with love and care. You want to make sure your communications, you know, are delivered with heart, you know. And even though they may not hear it, you know, they may not hear it mm-hmm. with that kindness. They may be processing it through, well, I don't like what she's saying. I'm still here. My arms are open. We're going to leave some stories, mm-hmm. and that'll be our legacy.
Yeah, yeah. Anything, any final thought or reaction to that, Monica?
Well, it is kind of refreshing to hear your thoughts on, like, conflict in the country, because as you were saying earlier, you know, you can't look back on your good or bad experiences and pick and choose. You know, you've gone through what you've gone through, and I think it's the same in regards to the country. You know, people like Trump, people dislike Trump, but ultimately it's a part of history that's going to have happened, you know. And so I was watching the Vietnam documentary recently, the Ken Burns, with my mom, and it's interesting to watch it with her because she went through all of that stuff. And I'm also thinking about what's going on in the country right now, and someday I'm going to be thinking about it like that. It'll be over. It'll have happened. It'll just be a story.
Yeah, it will be a story, but it will have been an experience that will have great impact mm-hmm. on the direction
every
of humanity.
Experience has
yes.
impact,
and
yes.
we can impact it. I mean, yes, I think that's the final hope. Piece that's, of this
yes,
is
yes.
not just to watch it as a movie that's occurring in our lifetime,
right.
but that we have a
You're
chance to impact it.
Mm-hmm.
You're playing in it.
Yes.
And how are you going to play?
Yes. Yes.
As you can tell, Satori Shakur is very persuasive, so she even talked me into sharing a few of my stories on stage about helping to open sports locker rooms to women journalists in the late 1970s and early 80s. And believe me, it wasn't easy. So thanks for listening, everybody. I hope you'll subscribe to our Powering Up podcast, tell your friends about it, and join me on Twitter and Instagram at Ann Doyle LDR or my website, Ann Doyle Leadership. We'd love to hear from you. And remember, power is the currency for getting things done. That's why getting comfortable with power is essential, and you're never too young or too seasoned to start. So let's go power up.